important phenomena, the politicization of the court system. Republicans, as we know, have systematically prepared judicial nominations. They have summer seminars for judges, including Supreme Court justices, where the virtues of the free market and conservative ideology are taught and expounded. They carefully groom and prepare candidates not only for positions on courts, but also in the district attorney system. Now, that development is, of course, important because our system, theoretically, depends on checks and balances. The notion, I think, of an independent court, ideologically independent, is clearly something of a mythology, but it's an important change. Media concentration is also another building block of this thing, and I don't have to belabor that point. We all know what it means, but it means once more the diminishing of alternatives, the suppression of alternatives without taking people to concentration camps or beating them up or even forcing them to do things they wouldn't want to do.
You're listening to Sheldon Wallen on Inverted Totalitarianism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online to our website, alternativeradio.org.
The homogenization of opinion that follows from this, I think, begins to look more and more like what it means to live in a system where a dominant ideology is really dominant. Other developments which contribute to that, not the least of them, is the changes in universities. This is a very important development, which probably hasn't received the attention it should have. But universities now are very, very deeply penetrated by corporations. In MIT, for example, corporate types sit on the faculty as regular faculty members without really being faculty appointments. There similarly are cooperative research undertakings between corporations and universities. Now, that what's important about that is it's one more tendency to undermine intellectual independence. This is seen most clearly on not only what's happening with the universities, but think about think tanks. Think about the fact that most of the think tanks in the country are bankrolled by corporations. The vast majority of them are conservative. The vast majority of them are Republican. And that means, again, that public discourse in this country is dominated very often by think tanks. Those of you who listen to NPR will hear the name Heritage Foundation or the Center for Strategic Studies. These are all conservative think tanks, yet it's their voice that gets represented because of this crucial role they play as the spokesman of a Republican ideology and as a method or a place where policy proposals are first generated, then passed on to the administration, so that they're integrated into the system, and the think tanks are no more independent than other branches of the party. Now, I do want to stress that the inversion of totalitarianism, as I've called it, is perhaps nowhere more strikingly displayed than in the fact, on the one hand, totalitarian regimes mobilize populations, regiment them, generally control them in some kind of unanimous goose step. But what was interesting, you recall that in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th incident, the president told the country, and I'm quoting from him, fly, consume, spend, and unite. Now, if you're at a war, in a war, as the war on terrorism was supposed to be, what you want is sacrifice and pull together. Let's all pitch in. But the president didn't ask anything of us. He told us to consume. The only thing he asked of us, chillingly, was, of course, to inform if we saw suspicious-looking people. But again, what I'm trying to get at, to put it very simply, Totalitarianism seeks to mobilize populations. Inverted totalitarianism seeks to demobilize them, seeks to keep them in a demobilized condition, which is exemplified not only by this example that I have given, but also by the kind of apathy which afflicts the public, and which there's no real effort on the part of political parties to generally attempt to affect. Now, this situation, let me close now by saying, is it's not easy to say what is to be done, because it's a system that's in position now, not simply something, one incident or one development or one tendency that's occurring. It's a combination of elements. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to call it critical totalitarianism. But then what do we do? Well, I think we have to begin by recognizing something which is sobering, but which I have come to believe more and more firmly. And that is that I think we make a mistake if we think about our political system as a democratic system. And that's not because the people in power are hypocrites. That's not it at all. It's rather that I don't think it's possible for democracy to be a political system under present conditions. That is to really overlay the whole thing, society, economy, government. The reason for that is democracy, I don't think, can govern a huge, complex society such as ours. And I think the day is past when it can. Now, there's also one other thing that contributes to that. And that is, it's a remark, if I can quote a remark of Aristotle. Aristotle said that democracy is the form of government run by those who work. Now, that's an important insight, because it means that you don't have time. You don't have time to participate all the time. And you don't have what the rich have, the ability to buy proxies, proxy representatives, proxy people in charge of pressure groups, all the rest of it, fundraising, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So democracy begins from a disadvantage. It begins from the fact that ordinary people work. And that means that their political possibilities are from the outset severely restricted. What that means, I think, are two things. One, I think you have to think of democracy, I think, first of all, as basically an opposition movement. That it's that getting into power is going, really into power, is going to be a rare occurrence the higher up you go in the hierarchy, higher up from local to county to state to federal. The higher up you go, the less the possibility of genuine democracy. You may get representative government or touches of it, but you won't really get democracy, because you're in a certain sense undercutting the whole point. The whole point being that if democracy is based on those who work should also be in power. Now, it follows from that, I think, that the democratic citizen has to be viewed as someone who does work, but who can find, nonetheless, opportunities to take part. And that means, I think, we get back, even though it may seem trite to say so, we get back to localism. The only thing in which we can really comprehend, both in our energies and even in our intellects, are things that lie closer to us, that we know something about, and that which are not of sufficiently large scale to overcome all the disabilities of democracy. That's not a cheery prospect, and I'm not cheerleading, because I think it's a relatively grim prospect we face. But I do think we can take heart, because there is democracy in the way I've defined it all over the country. It's isolated. It's weak. It tends to be occasional. It tends to be episodic. But I think that doesn't mean that it's either impossible, but what is impossible is to take over a system, because I don't think, when push comes to shove, that democracy wants to govern. And I don't think it ought to govern in the simple sense of the people running the system. I think instead we have to think in different terms. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I'll be glad to answer questions. Yes, all right, let's start right here.
You mentioned at the beginning of your talk that totalitarianism is expansive. Could you expand on that?
There's a lot of good scholarship on the nature of the Nazi regime, and there's a widespread consensus among scholars that the Nazi regime really had no point, that beyond expansion, war, mobilization for war, there was really nothing they really wanted to get, that the dynamism of war was their way of trying to push outward the energies that they were mobilizing internally. Mobilizing them internally meant regimenting, controlling, and that's what they wanted. But then the question became, what do you do with it once you mobilize? And the answer was war. Now, in the case of the Nazis, this mobilization was one that proved ultimately destructive for all the obvious reasons. They not only lost the war, the society was devastated. The point one's trying to get at here is to raise the question, and perhaps I didn't spell this out enough, is to raise the question, what's the dynamism that drives inverted totalitarianism? In the Nazis, it was called Lebensraum. That is, we need living space. Now, when we think about it, the answer I come up with is that the dynamism, that is what really drives that system, is a combination that's, first of all, never reached the point it has reached now in American political history. The interpenetration of corporations into the state machinery. That's a crucial, crucial development. But the second thing that and corporations, as we know, capitalism is expansive. It moves around. It wants markets here, there, globalization. We all know how that goes. At the same time, what is also there is the nature of contemporary capitalism, which depends so importantly on technology and the application of science to technology, to production. The nature of modern science, like modern technology, is to be continuously changing, to have a dynamic that forces it to do away with things it once believed in the past, with inventions it once believed in the past, and bring in something new. Computers are, of course, a beautiful example of it. But that kind of dynamism, which with the integration of science and technology into corporations, so that corporations now do more basic research than universities, gives to the American system, I think, the kind of push that the Germans got from other things. You're getting this integration of corporation and state now. Although the favoritism to corporations is an old story in American history, we know that. But what again one is talking about is the systematic relationship between the two. It's seen in little things. I mean, it's seen in things where you get corporate executives as the head of the departments of defense. At the same time, you get retired generals who go into corporations. One has to say that there are important differences of degree that set off this inverted system from classic totalitarianism. For example, under the Nazis, capitalists were not in the driver's seat. They were a significant element in the regime, and they supported the regime, but they did not call the tunes. So that the relationship between corporation, between big business, between capitalism, whatever you want to call it, and the system has now taken a sort of quantum jump because they're becoming indistinguishable. And I think that's the crucial point. They're becoming indistinguishable, something that simply was not the case with Nazism, as I've said. So, yes, sir.
At the end of your speech, you said democracy didn't want to rule. Mm-hmm. And was incapable of ruling. Those are pretty radical statements, mm-hmm. not what I expected mm-hmm. to hear. Thank you. But given the possibility that you're telling the truth and that you're right, what do you think we can hope for?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, you're right in what I said. But I think it's very important to remember that what I really meant to take seriously, the notion of ruling, of governing. And that's what I said democracy can't do. Let's just begin with a basic point. To govern a contemporary society, you have to have a bureaucracy, an administration. Administrations are hierarchical, they're anti-egalitarian. There's nothing democratic about government bureaucracies. Now, to say democracy is going to rule and use bureaucracy, as every government must in the contemporary state, is to me just sort of try to combine water and oil. It's just not going to work. That doesn't mean you don't vote for better candidates for office. That doesn't mean that at all. It just means, what are your expectations from supporting, let's say, Dianne Feinstein over against some Republican? And you say, well, maybe in the end it's Dianne. But however that may be, it's not going to mean democracy is going to live or die by that decision. It does mean, however, if you've got a school board, if you've got schools, if you've got local hospitals, if you've got 100 other things that are possibly within your control and that your participation in it can make a difference, it seems to me that's where you go. Because remember, the Dianne Feinsteins of this world, I don't mean that really invidiously, but they're going to demand less and less of you. They're going to say, pay your taxes and vote. And you don't even have to vote. Pay your taxes. But that's all they're really asking, because they'll keep you in law and order. You don't have to do that. They'll take care of seeing that you toe the mark. But it's not a democratic demand that they're laying on you. It's just not.
There's inherent flaws in democracy. Is there some other system that could be in some way representative of a broad range of individuals that might work in the obviously complex culture that we have come to live in?
Sure, there are. I mean, there are all kinds of proportional representation systems and other systems in which you can choose not simply one candidate, but several candidates. And if your candidate doesn't win, your vote gets moved down the column. They all exist. I mean, there are just so many problems with trying to introduce a new development into a system which is so systematized now and so dominated by money. And big money, really big money, and also by the collaboration between money and the media, that it's really very difficult to conceive of an electoral gimmick that will really change things. Because, again, the danger you can run, and this is something that the Weimar Republic that preceded Hitler ran into, and that is that they had systems of proportional representation, but the result was you splintered parties. You had a multi-party system with no party ever getting a majority. And this made for relatively weak governments at a time, this is during the Depression, the Great Depression, in which strong, effective state action was needed. One of the reasons the Nazis began to get greater and greater numbers of votes at the polls was that the people were becoming more and more disenchanted with a democratic system that seemed to connote weakness and bring weakness and division, rather than developing a coherent party with a majority system in which a party could really govern. Yes, miss.
Do you think that there's any way of redeeming the Democratic Party, of reminding them what they once stood for? Or does one simply vote for the Green Party because it's something new? I mean, I'd like to do something that will make a difference.
You see, again, we get back to the point. For the Democratic Party to compete against the Republican Party, it's got to compete in all the ways that the Republican Party has been successful, in fundraising, in media campaigns, and on, so that even if the Democratic Party has a certain will to move back to the left a bit, it's going to be very difficult, because the conditions under which parties compete now are not conducive to that kind of thing, plus the other fact which I pointed out, which I think the success of the Republicans in creating a generally conservative electorate. But I think you could certainly do far better than the Democrats have done. To make my point again, at a certain level, it doesn't mean much, because the more they're alike, it doesn't make much difference if they're even or not. It only makes a difference if there's a dissimilarity that's substantive. I guess I can't overemphasize that I'm really not talking about the Republican Party as such or the corporation as such. I mean, I don't hate Republicans. What I'm really talking about is a systematic organization of politics in a way that it has never been organized before. And the Republicans are just very good at it, partly because I suppose they come from more business backgrounds and management backgrounds than Democrats do. But again, one gets driven back to the point that this system would be perfectly delighted if you sort of shrugged your shoulders and said, screw voting. Once you get to that point, it's no longer a contest, because it's very difficult to figure out how you're going to crack it. There have been people who've tried to mount third parties in the last 10, 15 years, and not only Nader, but other people as well. And they haven't gone very far because they simply can't compete on the terms that the political game is being played now. They don't have the money. They don't have the media access. They don't have the core of pundits and think tank people to chant for them. It's very, very difficult to. And the history of third parties is just indicates how difficult it will really be to challenge the system on its own ground. Yes, ma'am.
You said tonight twice, we really need to be thinking differently. Can you jumpstart us along?
I tried to in a couple of ways. I mean, I'm trying to jumpstart you to think differently about where we are, and that's really and where we're going. At the end of the talk, I tried to suggest that, we start from where we are, and where we are is we're local, and that we've got to not only cultivate that, but we've also got to start thinking about some way to develop larger alliances and larger movements without thinking, I believe, that we need to start at this point a political party, because the terms on which we would have to compete are simply beyond us, that you can't compete with deep pockets and with organizations that work 365 days a year. So that, it's all around us. There are things we can do. And it's beginning, to hit home where we should be able to feel it and should be able to realize what's happening. I mean, what's happening to schools under the present budget constraints, what's happening to infrastructures, what's happening to hospitals and medical care. I mean, and those are the issues that really affect us and that affect our children and affect the communities in which we live. But we've got to start with those things, because those are the things in which we can begin with some kind of input, because those school boards are responsive up to a point, and so are boards of supervisors and all the rest of it. I mean, there are pressure points we can identify and work at, but it calls for people willing to make more of a commitment, evidently, than we've been able to generate. At bottom, if there's anything important about Democratic, small d, it's that ordinary people like all of us really should not be given or shouldn't look for recipes. That it's up to us to devise responses, solutions, to what we feel is pressing and urgent in the world around us. That we shouldn't look, that's what a democratic solution is. It's people with ordinary abilities and very ordinary free time at their disposal who can do that, who are willing to think about what could be done to improve the school thing, to improve libraries, to improve this, that, and the other thing. And I think that's part of what makes democracy more than a political system. It's an experience. It's an experience in which you grow with the challenges you're trying to meet, and you don't simply file to the voting booth on election day. Thank you.
You were just listening to Sheldon Wallen on inverted totalitarianism. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded in Willits, California in 2003. Sheldon Wallen was an award-winning scholar. He passed away in 2015. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Wendell Potter, Kuhan Pacmander, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Francesca Albanese, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Sheldon Wallen on Inverted Totalitarianism, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, A People's History of the United States, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, that's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
This is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Woo-hoo-hoo!